Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara. The government is to establish a commission of investigation in relation to mother and baby homes.
Where's the body? I've spent 36 years asking, where is my baby cousin Barry? And nobody's giving me answers.
Also, we'll discuss the Cook report into allegations of bugging at GSOC. First, we'll listen to the news, read by Eileen Whelan.
Good evening. The Cook report into allegations of bugging at the offices of the Garda Ombudsman Commission has found that the evidence does not support the proposition that GSOC had been under surveillance. The report has dismissed two of three security threats as not convincing and highly unlikely. The judge also finds that while the third threat remains unexplained, there is no evidence that it can be linked to An Garda Síochána. Here's our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
The Cook report, published this evening, dismisses claims that the Garda Ombudsman Commission's offices were under surveillance in the way it had been reported. Judge John Cook found the evidence does not support the proposition that actual surveillance took place, and much less that it was carried out by the Gardaí, as suspected by GSOC. The judge found accounts that a wireless AV remote control device was connecting to and transferring data from GSOC to an external hotspot as unconvincing. He found the alleged fake UK 3G network, believed to be an IMSI catcher, was highly likely to have been caused by the testing of a new 4G installation by a mobile provider in the area. And the judge also found that while the third threat, the phone ringback, remains unexplained, there's no evidence of Garda involvement. The Minister for Justice is now seeking a response from the Garda Ombudsman Commission and the Interim Garda Commissioner. The Ombudsman said tonight it's studying the report and will respond.
The Minister for Justice, Frances Fitzgerald, has said the government accepts the findings and conclusions of the report. She said it would form legislative changes relating to GSOC, and she called for a new culture of cooperation between Gardaí and the Ombudsman Commission. The Minister for Social Protection, Joan Burton, has told the Dáil that a special protocol has been established to protect families in private rented accommodation at risk of losing their homes. She said the arrangement had been agreed between the Dublin Region Homeless Executive, the four local authorities in Dublin and voluntary organisations, and she expected it to be fully functioning in the coming weeks. Northern Ireland's Director of Public Prosecutions has cast doubt over the value of letters issued to so-called on-the-runs as part of a deal agreed by Sinn Féin with the then British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Barra McGrory, who as a solicitor sometimes represented Sinn Féin, said that people with such letters could still be open to prosecution. The weather forecast: widespread thundery showers will die out to give a mainly dry night with clear spells. Mist or fog patches will develop, with lowest temperatures 9 to 11 degrees. Mainly dry tomorrow with sunny spells. And that's all for now. News again on Radio 1 at 11, but now it's back to The Late Debate.
Gurmeel Mahogath, Eileen, you're welcome back to The Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara standing in for Audrey this evening. Joining me in studio is Ciara Conway, TD of Labour, Catherine Ghent, Family and Child Law Expert, Justine McCarthy, columnist with the Sunday Times, and Father Vincent Toomey, Professor Emeritus of Moral Theology at NUI Maynooth. I'm joined on the line by Mick Clifford of the Irish Examiner and the Sunday Times as well, because we're going to start by looking at the Cook Report, a report by retired Judge John Cook into allegations of bugging of GSOC, or the Garda Ombudsman's office, which has been published this evening. Mick Clifford, what are the main findings of this report for anyone who hasn't heard the headlines?
Cormac, just to correct you first, I worked for the Irish Examiner, but that's neither here nor there. The main findings are that Judge Cook says that he finds no evidence, no definitive evidence to suggest that the GSOC offices were bugged. Now, that in itself is not as startling as it first might appear, because GSOC said that themselves when they reported to the minister last February that they found three anomalies that couldn't be explained, but they didn't suggest that this was definitive evidence that their offices were being bugged. What he did find is he investigated further the three anomalies, and in two of those, as a result of much deeper and wider investigation of what was behind them, he concluded that it would have been unreasonable to believe that they were the result of somebody trying to breach security. On the third one, which was the one that perhaps was most convincing, this was the one The security firm that were checking the line, they checked it, I think, after 1 a.m. in the morning. And as they checked the line, they immediately got a ring back. Now, apparently in the surveillance world, that's an indication that there was somebody at the end of the line, i.e. somebody was bugging it, whether that was a human or whether it was connected to a technical device. The judge says he still can't explain what exactly that was, but he has concluded that it is reasonable to assume that it was not a member of the Gardaí engaged in any illegal behaviour. Now, nobody has ever suggested that there was specifically a Garda bugging any device. So why he should conclude that, I don't know. People surmised that it perhaps on the basis that GSOC's main function was to investigate Gardaí, and therefore if under any circumstances they were being bugged, top of the list of suspects would possibly be an element or a member of an Garda Síochána.
And that unusual element, that relates to the callback, is that what you said?
That's the callback, yes.
And that callback happened at a very, in the early hours of the morning, if memory serves me right.
It was either 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning, and the security firm told GSOC at the time that the chances of it being anything other than some form of a device intent on listening in was close to zero. Kieran Fitzgerald, the commissioner, said this on prime time there back in February when this broke. So it seems that the judge has, in his conclusion, has certainly moved from that position, but he's an unusual conclusion in saying that it can't be attributable to a member of an Garda Síochána, which would strike me as conflating the issues as to whether it was bugged at all or whether that necessarily was a member of an Gardaí or somebody in some capacity in Gardaí doing the bugging.
Does the judge say categorically there was no bugging whatsoever, there was no evidence of bugging?
He says there is no evidence to support the allegation that there was bugging. And as I say, there was three elements to it. In two of them, it would seem, certainly taking into account the reports only published just over an hour ago, it would seem 400 pages, it would seem in two of them that the basis for his conclusions are pretty definitive. The third, I would suggest, still leaves open the possibility of anything. But, I mean, that doesn't mean it's unfair for the judge, on, if you were to use, say, the balance of probabilities, to suggest that that wasn't bugging. But I don't think he's not saying, I don't think it's possible to say definitively that that was not somebody attempting to breach the communication security of GSOC.
So in your opinion, Mick, does it actually bring clarity, or does it leave ambiguity in certain areas?
Well, I'd put it this way. In two of the three areas, I think on the from what I've seen of it, it sounds convincing that there's an explanation there other than bugging. That doesn't mean they weren't bugged. It means there's a body of evidence that suggests there's other explanations for them. As I say, the third one still leaves open a possibility. But you see, the thing about this, Cormac, is it should all be taken in context. If these technical anomalies were found in an organisation that wasn't engaged in any kind of very serious work against a powerful body, you could automatically conclude, okay, dismiss it, there's no chance anyone's bugging us. You have to put in context that last September in particular, the level of distrust and paranoia around relations between GSOC and the Gardaí was such that for the personnel in GSOC to believe that these anomalies could be connected to bugging, you'd have to conclude there was some reasonable basis for that.
Okay.
Particularly as we have been told by one of the commissioners that there was another incident that raised a suspicion in his mind that somebody may be bugging them.
But some people listening to you, some people reading the reports about the Cook report will think back to former Minister Alan Shatter and what he said about this, and they may conclude that, yes, Alan Shatter, in relation to this element of the controversy, was correct in what he said at the time. Would that be fair?
You could say that in one way, certainly. You could say that, but on what basis Alan Shatter said it is another matter, because he certainly could not have concluded it on the basis of any technical knowledge about these security breaches. The whole issue arose, in my opinion, on the basis of the reaction in government, particularly from the Taoiseach and Mr. Shatter. Their reaction from the outset was to divert attention from any notion that there was a possibility that these three anomalies could be attributed to somebody trying to bug GSOC. Now, it would appear that they were doing that for political reasons rather than any superior technical knowledge they may have possessed. And ultimately, that approach is what led to heightening the whole controversy that led to Judge Cook having to conduct the report. If the minister had, for example, on publication of the Sunday Times story, said, this looks like it may be something I'll get a second thorough, very thorough technical opinion, if he had done that, I don't think there would have been any of the controversy around it.
Finally, did the judge have adequate expertise available to him to ascertain if there was evidence of bugging or not? Because it seems, from a cursory look at the report, that this boils down to, was it actually digital or cloud surveillance? Was it that type of bugging? Or was it the old-fashioned surveillance based on hardware input into a certain system? And if it is the former, that is digital or cloud surveillance, it's extremely difficult to ascertain evidence of such bugging. Isn't that right?
Yeah, well, my understanding, and I'm not technically au fait with the whole thing, but my understanding of that whole area is that it has got so technical that my impression, or yours, or the average person's impression of what's involved in bugging is completely wide of the mark, that the thing is so technical that, you know, you don't have a man in a van with headphones listening into something or anything of that nature, that it is so technical that there's, in a lot of instances, there's no human input beyond setting a machine. So, you know, questions will probably still float around as regards it. But I think if you look at it in the broader picture, the whole thing comes back to the dysfunctional relationship between the Gardaí and the Ombudsman. If that relationship had not been as dysfunctional, this whole issue could have been, and most likely would have been, you would not have had the paranoia or the suspicion, and most likely would have been sorted out much earlier, and quite likely we may never even have heard about it.
Okay, Mick, Ciara Conway, Chachtadalla with Labour, is with me in the studio. This may not be so damaging for the government or for the department, but it certainly is. The Geeran report is far more damaging, isn't that right?
I think you're probably right. I haven't had the opportunity to look at it. It was only published this afternoon, late this afternoon. But based on what Mick has said there, you know, I think what is unhelpful about it is there doesn't seem to be clarity in relation to what exactly did happen. And I think, and I would have thought, that the whole purpose of the report was to bring clarity to the matter. But I think as well, you can't look at this out of context. And at the at this time, I think Mick makes a very significant point that the level of distrust that existed between GSOC and An Gcomhairle Síochána was palpable. You know, it wasn't just any old organisation that there was a concern about. It wasn't our local library that somebody was trying to use the Wi-Fi outside of. You know, this is a significant organisation that has huge oversight over An Gcomhairle Síochána in this country. So, I mean, you know, I think at the time, it was, but I think you're right that, you know, it would appear that former Minister Shatter was correct in what he said in relation to this part of the controversy.
But as Mick Clifford says, on what basis did he form that opinion? Okay, we'll leave that there. Mick Clifford of the Irish Examiner, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Ciara is obviously staying with us along with the rest of the panel. Catherine Ghent, family and child law expert, Justine McCarthy of the Sunday Times, and Father Vincent Toomey, Professor Emeritus of Moral Theology at NUI Maynooth. You can contact the programme.
St. Patrick's College.
Okay, I'm getting a lot wrong. I'm sorry. You can contact the programme by text 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, and you can follow us on Twitter at latedebate.rte. The government has announced a commission of inquiry into mother and baby homes, as you've heard in the headlines, but questions surround the announcement already. Will it really be able to get to the truth, given how much time has passed? Will it receive cooperation? Will the terms of reference be wide enough? Minister of Children Charlie Flanagan spoke earlier with Brian Dobson on the 6-1 News regarding the announcement.
The process is such that the Commission of Inquiry has been announced. Over the past week or more, a high-level group across a range of departments has been working by way of a scoping exercise to establish the facts. Eight government departments, a number of agencies like the National Archives, like the Office of Public Works, are, if you like, setting the scene for what will be a fully-fledged Commission of Inquiry. I'm most anxious that there be all-party consensus on this issue from Leinster House and beyond. We need to establish the terms of reference by the early summer.
Right. Can I just... One specific area is this issue of the vaccinations of babies in homes. Now, there was an attempt to investigate that some years ago, and that was prevented by a Supreme Court judgment. Now, will that issue be within the scope of this investigation?
I acknowledge that there are some serious, complex legal issues attached to the process. I'm anxious that they be surmounted. I'm also conscious that there are privacy and data protection issues. I'm cognizant of the difficulties of previous commissions of inquiry, and I intend to ensure that the legal issues are surmounted and that we can have a comprehensive inquiry encompassing the issues as you raise.
And would you hope that it will be conducted in public, that people will be able to follow these proceedings, that there will be that full transparency?
Yes, insofar as practicable and insofar as is legally possible. And I will be liaising with the Attorney General on this issue. It's my intention, and indeed the intention of the government, that as much as is legally possible will be transacted in public. And of course that the report will be published and the recommendations contained therein will be acted upon.
Another aspect of this, of course, which has been discussed in recent days, is the nature of the adoptions that that arose at this time. And people campaigning on this issue today say that there are serious shortcomings in legislation in terms of the rights of adoptive people to find out who were their natural parents, and indeed vice versa, for mothers to trace their babies. Is that legislation been long promised in this area? Will we see legislation?
This is an issue that my department is addressing. I am of the view, and have been for some time, that the most possible information be available to the parties involved. That does involve some legal, complex constitutional issues. Had a meeting as recent as last week with the Attorney General on this issue, and I'm anxious that the legislation in that regard would be settled and published at the earliest opportunity. But so I am conscious, Brian, I'm conscious of the fact that this isn't easy and that there are rights to be balanced
on both sides
among a number of parties.
I accept the need
for change.
A simple question. Should an adoptive person have the right to see their original birth certificate?
Yes, insofar as that is legally possible. I am of the view that that is a human right that should be respected by our law.
And that was Charlie Flanagan, Minister of Children, speaking with Brian Dobson on the 6-1 News earlier today. Ciara Conway of Labour, he spoke of the Commission of Inquiry looking into high mortality rates at the homes, at burial practices and at the adoptions and the vaccine questions. Now, I know this is relatively vague at the moment, but are those references, those terms of reference, I know they're not specific at this stage, but is that wide enough, do you think?
I think, you know, it's a good start. And I think, you know, the fact that it is a commission that's been set up in accordance with the Commission Act of 2004, which gives it compellability and gives it legal standing, I think is going to be hugely important to, you know, to having a good and a satisfactory outcome for the families and for the women. And I think what's equally important, and I was present in the House tonight when he spoke about it and when the opposition spokesperson said there are and there is going to be a great amount of cooperation across the House to ensure that we get this right. Because I think, to be fair to this government, there is a lot of things that you could say we have gotten wrong. But there are, and we have, are facing up to some very dark things in the past. And I know, and I would like to believe, from, you know, from listening from the Taoiseach, from listening to my colleagues in the Labour Party, that they have been very supportive in the last number of days to ensure that this is a commission that does what we need it to do.
But Justine McCarthy, am I right in saying that you believe this should be even wider than is being proposed at the moment?
I find the title of the commission worrying. It suggests to me that its terms of reference are going to be too restrictive. I'd prefer to have something called maybe a commission of inquiry into the maltreatment of females and children in Ireland.
That's extremely broad, though.
perhaps institutional maltreatment, because this is primarily a story about how Irish women have been discriminated against by the state, and children were deemed to be guilty by association. And I think you have to tell the entire story. Justice for Madeleine, the JFM research, the Justice for Madeleine people put out a statement today saying that this investigation has to look at the Magdalene laundries. UNCAT, the UN Commission Against Torture, criticised the McAleese report on the Magdalene laundries for not fully investigating a number of aspects of the Magdalene laundries. I think we've got to, from the outset, make sure that all the records are made available, that people such as Orders of Nuns cannot say, well, sorry, we don't have these records. There are records strewn across the state departments. And we also have to fireproof the ability of this inquiry to investigate something like the clinical drugs trials, which was stopped, that the last commission, the Lafoy Commission, was stopped by the Supreme Court from doing that because of a challenge taken by one of the doctors involved.
Okay, now, Catherine Ghent, we're just looking at the scope of the investigation before we drill down deep into some of the issues that may pertain to the investigation. Do you think the scope is wide enough? Do you think they are relevant points addressed by Justine McCarthy?
I think that they are relevant points, and I think that they need to be looked at. I think what we need is a workable framework and a workable frame of reference. And in that regard, I think that the scoping exercise is necessary. It must be approached in a very open-minded manner to see what are the areas we can investigate thoroughly and properly, what would lend itself to proper investigation and learning for the future. And I think that there may well have to be prioritisation of issues.
What would you mean by proper investigation? What would lend itself to proper What wouldn't lend itself to proper investigation in this context?
Well, I suppose we've spoken about, or Justine has spoken about, the necessity for records and documents to be handed over. It's crucial that all those records and documents are handed over. There should be ascertainable facts contained within those documents in respect of which investigations can clearly be made and findings found. In relation to the more tenuous aspects of it, they're going to require careful thought as to how best to conduct that aspect of the investigation. I mean, I would see this ultimately perhaps as being a commission of investigation in relation to quite a wide range of specific chapters perhaps within that investigation. I mean, you have things as wide as states' involvement, state sanctioning, I don't know if there's state funding, to issues of bodies of babies being given to medical schools without consent, to forced adoptions, illegal adoptions. Each one of those individual areas is a minefield, and yet is an area absolutely necessary of investigation.
You paint a picture of an absolutely massive investigation.
I think it's necessary that it is. How to make a massive investigation manageable will be the key, and I think that's probably going to be a very difficult job for whoever is left in charge of it.
Could it possibly run years? Could it be modular, like the Mahon Tribunal, for example? Could it be that extensive and that long of a duration?
Well, I think what you'd hope is that you wouldn't see what you saw in that tribunal, namely that there would be full cooperation from everybody involved. I don't know if the distance in terms of time at this stage would assist in this. It could also be used to as an excuse, for example, we don't have this, we don't have that. Sure, there's no point in going down this line of inquiry. But I would hope that it would be speeded up by full cooperation. And I think in relation to recent commissions, those processes have not taken as long, have not been as expensive, and I think that no one wants that to arise. But yet we do want, I think we need to be clear, we want these matters investigated to find the truth, and we also want them investigated so that we have learning for the future, so that we sit down as a society, and when we talk about us as a society, we are a group of individuals with individual responsibility. If we judge people, if we label them as outcasts, and if we push them to the edge of society, as happened to these women and these children, and Justine is right, there's institutional maltreatment, but there's societal maltreatment as well. And I think that one of the purposes I'd like to see of this investigation and arising from it is opportunity for learning and questioning of ourselves in relation to those issues now.
OK, I'll bring in Father Vincent Toomey at this stage, just regarding the scope of the investigation. It could be very, very broad indeed.
Yeah, well, I agree with what is said just now, especially by Justine. I do think it has to be broader than perhaps just these particular homes. There was a report in the Irish Times today by Sean Lucy of Belfast who said that 70% of single and lone mothers and their children ended up in the so-called county homes, you know. And that has been, I don't know, is that part of the investigation? It should be. It has to be.
Would you include the Magdalens?
Of course, although I think the Magdalens has already been looked at, you know, but if there's dissatisfaction, it must be looked at again. I do think the big question I would have to ask is, what is the purpose of this investigation? Is it going to be a criminal investigation or is it going to be a historical investigation? Catherine was just saying that we have to learn from this. Of course we have. But I think we also have to quote somebody earlier, put it in context. So I think a historical element must be there. There must be some historical social history. Social historians must look at the situation at the time. What were these, attitudes to women, and where did they come from? That sort of thing. Yeah.
The Gardaí, as Minister Charlie Flanagan said earlier, are engaging in a scoping exercise of their own. If there is a criminal investigation launched, do you think that changes things in relation to this commission of inquiry?
I think it does, because immediately, we're looking for somebody to find guilty straight away. Most people are, a lot of these people would be dead anyhow, from in the early part of the century. But I do think it kind of is already judging the issue without actually asking what was the historical situation of Ireland after the independence, a terribly impoverished country. The position of the church in that country, the position of the relation between church and state, all these things have to be considered, I think.
But you're not suggesting that if there is a need for a criminal investigation...
Then it has to be done, of course.
But that causes difficulty. Is that would you agree with that, Catherine Gend?
Well, I think that they have to be two separate processes. Just to be very clear, it is not the purpose, and nor would the Commission of Inquiry seek to make findings of guilt or innocence. That would be totally inappropriate. And within the structures of the Act are protections, in fact, for witnesses who are compelled to come towards them. For example, they must be told of the substance of the evidence, given an opportunity. If issues arise that they object to, they must be given an opportunity to set that out. They're also compelled to set it out in affidavit. They're compelled, there's powers of compellability in relation to documents, etc. But they're entirely separate to the criminal process. That must be independent.
Absolutely. But if there is a concurrent criminal investigation, does it change the rules of engagement then by various parties with the Commission of Investigation? Because if you are going forth towards a Commission of Investigation, you're more likely to lawyer up, aren't you? Even in a Commission of Investigation, if you know there's a criminal investigation hovering in the background.
Well, if you look at who that would affect, I mean, who potentially would be the subject of a criminal investigation? Is it going to be the state? Is it going to be individuals within the homes? I mean, we have heard horrendous stories of, for example, pain relief being refused, of appalling treatment. And in relation to the other issues that Justine mentioned, there may be some criminal matters there. But I think that what people need to remember is that there's a different purpose to the commissions of investigation. It's to fulfil a different role. If someone thinks that their rights are going to be transgressed in such a way before the Commission of Investigation, in such a way as would prejudice a criminal trial, then of course they're entitled to bring in legal representation. And indeed they should, because we can't have a situation and the alternative, where people are brought in and hung out to dry. It has to be done in a fair and balanced way with due regard for due process.
Ciara Conway, can you foresee that happening then?
I mean, it's really hard to know. I mean, just like going around the table, how broad of an issue this is, you know, how varied the questions are. But I think, you know, what strikes me and what has struck me all along when you look back at how women were treated by various arms of the state is that it was a manifestation of official policy at the time. And that's what people have to remember, you know, and that's the really chilling thing about it. I mean, there was mention there of county homes. But like county, there was even like a social strata within how women and children were dealt with. County homes were for the poorer girls. and the mother and baby homes were for the more middle class girls. You know, so like this is like such a varied and, you know, socially disturbing part and chapter of our history. And, you know, some of these homes were still in existence right up into the 80s and 90s. So, you know, it's so broad that, yes, it might take a long time. And I think maybe Catherine, the point that Catherine makes, that there is a huge amount, there are a lot of issues that need, because there's the children who died, potentially. There's the women that lived there with their children on some of the campuses. There are the children that were illegally given up for adoption. And there are children that, you know, disappeared, that we have no right. Like, it is so multifaceted that, yes, it will be difficult to maybe get a commission that will be able to examine all those things. But we have to try, because if we do not, we'll be back here again with some other dark story, with other some dark episode in our history. And always at the expense of poor women predominantly.
It also, just talking about the scope and the range of issues that need to be addressed by the Commission of Investigation, Justine, it raises the question, who should, number one, lead the Commission of Investigation, and how many members actually should should be comprised of the commission?
I think that's a vital question. We have seen from, you know, the tribunals and commissions we've had how much they depend on the personality of the chairperson. I would think Judge Yvonne Murphy did tremendous work in the commission that looked into the Dublin and Cloyne diocese. Somebody of her calibre, I think, would be wonderful. I have no problem at all with a judge doing it. I think it should be primarily a judicial investigation, because it should be a massive investigation. This should be the inquiry to end all inquiries, because we can't keep having these every time there's a new revelation. I think the other question is, where should it stop? You know, what would be the sort of calendar parameters of this? I would imagine it will be from the foundation of the state, because we inherited a lot of this, these systems actually in the handover from Britain. But do you, for instance, include symphysiostomy, which is, you know, something that has affected many women going back decades, and women who are still suffering severe consequences. And this is all wrapped up in what Catherine was talking about, the societal aspect of this and the whole culture of the way that women were treated.
But Catherine, if it's too wide-ranging, could it lack probative value then?
But again, that goes back to what Justine's just saying, and Ciara, in terms of who you get to do it.
But even if you get the greatest judge in the history of legality, and you put before him too wide a range of issues, and too wide in terms of the range of issues, and then the issues themselves being extremely deep and historical, there is a danger that they could gulf even the best judge in history.
But that's about proper resources. I mean, one judge could not investigate all of those issues. I mean, if you're going to set up a commission, it's going to have to be properly staffed, properly resourced. You know, either we do this properly or we don't. Of course, one person can't do all that, but you're going to need one person to oversee or coordinate it. And that's what's important.
Justine? I'd see it as being a twin track or even a three track investigation. The Lafoy Commission, which became the Ryan Commission, it had a confidential committee as part of it, which was chaired by Nora Gibbons of Barnardo's, who's now the chair of the TUSLA, the Family and Child Agency. And that committee wrote a fantastic report based on the first-hand accounts of the witnesses who have been in the institutions, and that is a very powerful piece of social history that is there for generations to come. So I think if we have, say, a judicial inquiry, and within that have possibly an investigative sort of outlet that will go through the records and the documents, and also maybe the academics. If you look at what the academics did with the Magdalene Laundries, it was they who actually brought that to the attention of the UN And, you know, they have now compiled a social history of what happened in the laundries.
OK, we have a huge number of texts to 51551. Anne says, we still have no regulation and statutory rights of children to have the father's name on birth certs. The mother can choose to omit the father's. Will this be the scandal of the future? Children have rights and certainly have a right to know the father. Another texter says, without identities of families which place pregnant daughters in such homes, another inquiry will be incomplete. Incomplete, says that texter. Another texter, Tommy in Wicklow, says, if alleged wrongdoing is found after the investigation, can the results of the investigation be sent to the DPP for criminal investigation by the Gorthy? Yes, says Catherine Gent. Is that right? Yeah, I think she thinks so. Anyway, looking at it summarily. Father Vincent Toomey, the bishops so far have said that the church will cooperate and the orders will cooperate with the commission of investigation. But is that likely to change if there is, as we said, a criminal investigation, and if the nature of the investigation changes?
I doubt it. I think the we're as anxious as anyone that the truth will be known. And I gather you mentioned, Tulsa was mentioned recently. Somebody said that quite a lot of the records are actually already in the hands of Tulsa, in the government, you know, so that the when these houses closed down, the records went to them. So I don't think there's any need to fear that there'd been a lack of cooperation, you know. But again, you know, we shouldn't forget that this whole thing, this whole problem arose with a sensational report about 800 children being buried in a sewage tank or in a septic tank, you know. And that has actually, I think, coloured the whole way. And immediately the sisters of the Bon Secours have been seen as the guilty ones, practically. We need a scapegoat, you know.
And you're saying that's not the case.
We have to find out the truth. Let's not actually condemn.
But did you use the word sensational in a pejorative sense?
Oh, I do make in a pejorative sense.
Why so?
It went around the world, you know. And was picked up by the whole international media. The here again is the Irish church having made a mess of things.
But 800 bodies in a mass grave, unmarked, is relatively sensational, is it not?
But are there 800 bodies in the grave?
Well, so Catherine Corliss said.
She didn't say that at all, yeah.
Did she not?
No, she had 800, a record of 800, of 796
children,
you know. And she knows some were probably buried there because of a report of two lads who fell into this crypt, as she called it, and discovered that there were some skeletons there, and they reckoned about 20. But the thing is...
But she made the point, and this is important, if it isn't 800, she says, it's 10 or 20 or 30 or 40,
of course,
does that make it less important?
Not in the slightest, yeah. But the percentage, the presentation of it in terms of 800 in a septic tank, that caused, you know, huge tsunami of outrage throughout the whole world.
But maybe the sensational aspect of the story came from the fact that we have 700 names. We don't know where they are. We don't have a grave for them. Surely that's malpractice at the very, very least.
Again, I don't know. Hopefully the investigation will actually look into that, you know. They were recorded. Their deaths were recorded. Evidently, there were records of those who died. The little reading I've done about it, you know, in the meantime, has been that the situation in these homes was pretty desperate. There was malnutrition. There was, infant mortality was very high.
It was extremely high. And that's one of the aspects that's to be investigated. Let's drill down a little deeper. Why do you think mortality rates within the homes were so high?
Well, again, I leave that for the Well, first of all, I just quoting other people. You have people who are malnourished, you know, undernourished, who pick up children, pick up diseases very, very quickly. There wasn't the same kind of care that anywhere that you have today for children and after childbirth. And once TB takes over, it just runs through a whole institution. Yeah?
And the Bon Secours sisters were charged with the day-to-day running of the home. And you were saying that they were already guilty in the eyes of reporters who sent reports throughout the world.
Exactly.
They were charged with the day-to-day running of the home, and you outlined a lack of nourishment, a lack of care.
But they were appealing to the government for monies.
They got some money, isn't
that
right?
They got a little bit of money, but very little, yeah. Ireland was an extremely poor country at the time, yeah.
But mortality rates generally in Ireland were at 7 or 8% in the 40s and 50s, I think. Based on a UCD study that I looked at earlier on today, it could stand corrected. Mm-hmm. Mortality rates in the homes were between 30 and 50%. That's extremely, that's a multiple of the mortality rate generally.
Again, I mean, I had other statistics that I looked at. It wasn't, it said 8.5% compared to 10% in Limerick and things like that. But I mean to say, you know, I don't. We're already sitting in judgment, and all I want to say
I'm just asking legitimate questions.
Well, the thing is that we don't know what these resources these nuns had. We don't know what efforts they made to help these children and these mothers. We do know there was a lot of prejudice around. There's no doubt about that. We do know that we inherited from the British system that we entered into a very bad attitude to so-called fallen women. You know, this was part of the Victorian United Kingdom that we emerged out of, and we had a young state trying to get on its feet. And we just continued the practice, as was happening in England and other places, to get rid of these unfortunate people who, according to the thinking in Britain at the time, were people whose morality was questionable. You know?
Justine McCarthy,
it wasn't just a Catholic thing.
Okay, it's too early to apportion blame or to apportion responsibility at this stage of the investigation. Would you go along with that?
I think we should probably have open minds, but I really have to go back to something that Father Vincent said there. To ascribe our scorn of so-called fallen women to colonial Britain, it really is unbelievable. In a country that has been dominated by the Catholic Church since its foundation, the Church which has an active policy of discrimination against women. The Vatican State is based on discrimination against women. All the teaching that we grew up with as females was that women were somehow inferior. And there's almost this bar we were expected to reach, which was set by the virgin birth. And this idea that somehow giving birth was a dirty business. Now, any time I ever mention this, process or this ritual of churching, which my mother was subjected to and many women of her generation, and which she was very distressed by. Anytime I mention it, I get letters from learned theologians telling me I don't know what I was talking about and that was not the purpose of it. The women who were subjected to it believed the purpose of that ritual was to purify them because they were dirty after childbirth. And that is the attitude that has defined the treatment of women in this country since 1922.
Well, I don't deny what you're saying. I grew up in that era as well. I remember going with my mother to, as she was being churched when my brother was actually baptized, after he was born, rather, had been baptized. And I'm not denying that the church also has a responsibility, but that it has the entire responsibility that I would actually question. Yeah, I do think that our colonial past, the fact is we came out of, you know, this is the historical thing, I think, which has to be examined, you know. We came out of the underground as a church into Victorian England. And we adopted many of the Victorian values. I've discussed this in my book, The End of Irish Catholicism, ? Yeah? The attitude to fallen women, so-called, was articulated in the new poor law in 1833, I think, yeah, where for the first time fathers were excused. Up to then, fathers had to actually pay for the upkeep of their children. They were excused that burden in order to prevent these women from actually making a mess of things further, you know. So there was quite a frightening look down on women of low virtue, as they were called. This fed into, if I might say so, this fed into whole secular situation in Irish society, and it fed into a type of Catholic moral theology that was rigoristic, that saw every pleasure as a sin, sort of.
Kira Conway,
what do you make of that?
You know, I find it difficult to square the circle because I would have thought when the Republic was being born in those early days, the last thing that Irish society wanted to do was take on more customs from the British. The last thing, because they wanted to become an independent republic. So and they were a fledgling country, a learning country, and they turned to the church for the most part for a constant in their life, because life was difficult then. And I don't disagree that it was or it wasn't.
But administratively and legally, it did take patterns from Britain. I don't know if we're getting lost in history and in trying to deal with the various elements of the report and trying to explain the context of the time, but it did take, now I'm not saying one way or the other, but it did take the court service, for example, it took.
Yeah, I know, I mean the parliament which I sit in, I mean, Absolutely. It's pretty much based on it, the laws that I pass.
But you're saying as a fledgling nation, as a new independent nation, we did it our own way. Is that right?
Well, I mean, I don't disagree that, I mean, you just look at India in terms of the kind of, they took on the same bureaucratic system that the British had. But I mean, we're not just talking about a bureaucratic system about how they dealt with women. We're talking about how socially and morally women were judged. And they were judged to be immoral and were treated as such. They were treated as unequal. And that's just the way it was. They were treated as unequal regardless of whether they were pregnant or not. Is the first thing. And then if they were pregnant outside of wedlock, well, then there was a social stigma of shame had to be imposed on them. And it was by sending them to these institutions. And just to go back to Tuam, and I have some of the figures. So in the 36 years, in a 36 year period, there was 796 children died in the home in Tuam. Now, that accounts for one child in 1958, but there was 53 in 1947. So there was an average of about 22.2 deaths per year in that home. But in a 10-year period, you had over 3,500 children been born in that home. Like, what happened to those other children, the ones that are alive? And there are just so many multifaceted questions.
Absolutely. You know. And that's a point Minister Charlie Flanagan made. Susan Lohan, Father Vincent Toomey, picks you up on a point. Susan Lohan of the Adoption Rights Alliance picks you up on a point you made earlier. Please correct Father Vincent's outrageous statement that the religious orders got little money from the state to run these mother and baby homes. A, they tendered for the business. B, the entire system was devised by the Catholic Church hierarchy in concert with the state. C, they got the equivalent of the average industrial wage per woman and child in their so-called care. And all of this for providing meagre rations in an industrial-style setting. The apologists are out already, she says.
Well, if that is true, that's very sad. But again, my starting point was, let's see what the facts were. You know, when was that? Was that in 1925, 1940? Was that during the war? You know, when was it 1950? And then of course, things become less. You say if that is true. Yeah.
But you challenged that point a few minutes ago.
I'm challenging the blanket condemnation of the order of the Bon Secours.
And to support your point, yeah, you said they had little money. You didn't know that for a fact.
No, I did know it because I've been reading some things where they've been looking for support from the government.
Are you saying Susan is wrong then? You
know? I don't know what era she's speaking about. Yeah, whether it was the 50s, the 60s, or whether it was the 70s, or whether it was the 40s or the 20s.
But certainly the
figures that I looked up, you know, people, there was they approached in 1949, I think, Senator Quinn looking for help. He said, we don't want to talk about that sort of thing, you know, for help, for more help.
Justine McCarthy.
It has been reported that the Bon Secours sisters were receiving a capitation fee of £1 per child and per mother, and they were running the home at the behest of Galway County Council. Now, I think another order of nuns, was it the Sacred Heart nuns who ran three homes, Besborough, Castle Pollard and Sean Ross Abbey in Roscrea, that they were seeking extra money. But you have to, it's hard looking back now, but you have to balance the money that they were getting with the service that they were providing. And if you read the report of James Deaney, the chief medical officer of the Department of Health, you can see it was a very bad service.
Can I bring in Solicitor Catherine Gent at this point? Because I don't want this programme to end without alluding to illegal adoptions and vaccination trials on these children. Can this really be, can we get to the bottom? Can we get to the truth of the forced adoptions, for example, or the vaccination testing in this commission of investigation?
Well, what I'd like to see is everybody who has the opportunity making themselves and any documents that they have available to ensure we have the best chance of getting to the truth. The scandal of illegal adoptions, the consequences for people, the lack of general information is hugely devastating. That in itself is an incredibly complex area.
And some people might have a very fundamental question. How were they illegal?
Well, if you don't have consent and a child goes off, and I mean, I've read of instances of where there were falsified passports and falsified papers and children going to America. And of course, following that will be, was any money exchanged? There are lots of questions.
So literally taking a baby from a mother against her consent and adopting that baby, is that?
Well, that will need to be investigated, certainly. And I mean, I have read the media reports. I haven't had any inside track on that, but I know that there have been such reports. And it will be very important that those matters are investigated. But also, it's a timely reminder of the need to overhaul the adoption legislation to give people who have been adopted necessary information at its most basic level in relation to their medical history.
You're saying to this day, people who are adopted are still waiting for that information. They
still
can't access.
Waiting for information. It has massive consequences.
Ciara Conway.
Yeah, no, just to go back on a point Catherine raised there, there is evidence that in the Department of Foreign Affairs, the travel documents were issued for these children who, you know, with what it looks like now, falsified birth certs, that, you know, these people would come into the country, they would be registered as their parents. And then, you know, so like there's huge issues here in terms of identity and tracing for children. And I know that, and I know Susan, who contacted the programme in relation to the Adoption and Tracing Bill. And I know that this is going to be a very significant piece of legislation. And I'm very hopeful that the heads of this bill will be published very soon. And I think then we can start to tease out those issues that are, you know, that adopted people have the absolute right to know where they came from and at the very least their medical records.
Father Vincent Toomey.
Is it true that before 1952 there was no legislation for adoption?
Yes.
I think so, yes.
So and to what extent are all these stories actually from that the period before legislation or after legislation?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things the Commission will identify, what is the appropriate period to begin. But what were the regulations at the time? Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably there was some regulation. If there wasn't, we'll have to find out. And but where was compliance and what was
and
it?
And why was Justine? There no regulation?
Absolutely.
Because Archbishop John Charles McQuaid did not want any legislation on adoption, and that will be part of the story as well.
But even if there was no legislation to take a baby from a mother, if that happened without the consent of the mother and to adopt that baby with little or no documentation, seems against any moral code.
Of
and just
is,
sorry,
yeah.
Consents were sometimes obtained, but it was the legitimacy of the consent. I mean, I heard a woman yesterday saying, I was really surprised when they showed me the document because I was so traumatised and I'd just given birth that I wasn't even aware I had signed it. So, you know, on the one hand you have what's purported to be a consent, but it's going to be legal consent. There's just two brief things I want to say. In relation to people who feel that they are accused before they would come before a commission of inquiry, in an attempt not to deter them or stop them from coming, they need to know that their rights will be protected and there are mechanisms for that. But equally, in response to a text which came in about wanting to know the names of families, for people who want, and we want to come forward and give evidence and give their stories to the commission, they need to be reassured that their identities and their privacy will be respected as well.
Dara Gallagher contacts us on Twitter. He says, let's not forget these mother and baby homes were run as businesses, not as charities. The nuns profited, the children died, he says. Is that sensational or is that accurate, Justine McCarthy?
We don't really know. This was an issue that came out of the McAleese report on the Magdalen laundries, and there was great disappointment that that report didn't actually deal comprehensively with how profitable it was for the laundries. The report found that they didn't actually make a profit, but there is evidence that some of them did. Could I just say, Cormac, as well, I hope that the Protestant mother and baby homes are going to be included in this, because they have fallen through the cracks in every investigation up to now. Like Bethany Home in Dublin, where 222 children's bodies were buried. The Crow's Nest in Dunleary, where the clinical drug trials were carried out. And, you know, I know I have been talking a lot about the influence of the Catholic Church, but in a way, it's almost like reverse discrimination that they have not been investigated.
It certainly was implied, Ciara Conway, by Minister Charlie Flanagan, that they would be included.
I have to say, I was, you know, I very much welcomed that, you know, because, you know, I think, you know, it has been a shortcoming that they have been left out in the past. But I understand that the Bethany Homes will be included in this. And I think, you know, that's only right and proper. But I know we're running out of time. I just want to make a point, bringing it right up to now, to 2014. It's worth remembering that the children's rights referendum in this country has still not been passed. It's still been challenged in our courts. So we talk about how we treated women and children in the past, but there are many, many modern day examples of how women and children are being discriminated against in relation to sexual health and reproductive rights, and to the fact that the children's rights referendum is still has still not been brought into law after it had been passed by a majority of the people. And thirdly, we had a very recent report about children in care, over 200 children who died in our care system, and one of the major and the most common risk factor in all of those cases was the abuse and the risk caused by alcohol. And still the government and some ministers in government refuse to rule out at the abolition of alcohol advertising for sports.
Not to mention the status of refugees who are in limbo, not to mention also recent racial profiling of traveller children in the poll system. There is a problem nowadays as well, is there?
There absolutely is. I mean, as someone has said, the direct provision system is so appalling. There will be a state apology at some stage for how we are treating people now. And I think what someone said last week was, we don't need apologies, you need action. On the children's referendum, I would love to hear what steps the government are taking to ensure that that is dealt with. It has been floating around now. It was passed by the people in November 2012, and it still has not been signed into law, and its state is still uncertain to a degree. If this was a fiscal referendum, there was no way the government would sit back and bemoan the fact that it hadn't gone through. So I would really welcome the government making further efforts to expedite that, or see what the delay is, and the Attorney General to just take whatever steps she can and are necessary to get that through.
Why the delay?
Well, as I understand it, there was a legal challenge taken to it, but I absolutely agree with Catherine. I'm only a mere backbencher. I mean, if you look at my record, I have been campaigning on this issue before I was ever in the Dáil and since I've been in the Dáil, and I'll continue to do so. I think you're absolutely right. If it was,
and it's not about interference in the court process or the decisions. It's absolutely not about that. It's about priority. People look for
and
priority.
Catherine will know this, and I know this.
Can I just say to you, saying you're a mere backbencher simply is not good enough, because people acquiesced in the same way probably in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and awful things happened. You could leave the Labour Party in protest.
And do what? And what would that do?
Highlight the problem.
What would I be able to do from the opposition? But if you want to make a change, you have to do it in government. And I mean, I think it's very unfair. You can look at my track record. I'm one of the only people who has consistently called and monitored this. And I think you're right. I would call on my colleagues to support me to do it, because people do bemoan what happened in the past when we're faced with children who are currently in the care system, who are waiting to be adopted, and time is running out for them as they approach their 18th birthday. I am very aware of that, and I welcome the opportunity to say that here.
I'll give Father Vincent Toomey the last word.
Well, first of all, I think the main really purpose of the commission is to find out the truth, you know, and that everything must come out. But I do think that commission would also need an international dimension. And I think there should be some lawyer or some major figure from Europe who will actually also help to put this into perspective. Because these issues are not just Irish, they're English, they're also partially European. And these have to be looked at as
well. Okay, you have the final word there. I hope we dealt with this distressing topic in a sober and sensitive manner this evening. I'll give Kath on text the last word. While it's good to get engaged with our past, why can we not engage in the same way with the here and now? Six babies die in Port Leisha Hospital. Parents not told why. Medical cards taken from the very sick children and adults. Children going to school hungry. Asylum seekers living in appalling conditions for years. When will the government apologise for these crimes, she says. My thanks to Ciara Conway, Catherine Ghent, Justine McCarthy and Father Vincent Toomey and earlier Mick Clifford.
The Late Debate, presented by Cormac O'Hara, was produced by Kay Sheehy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney, the researcher is Richie Byrne, and sound supervision tonight was by Dave Gibson.